Today is Tuesday, June 28th. It is 1:30 p.m. And are we ready to start? I think we are. Call the meeting to order. Can we get a roll call, please?
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Mike O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Groper.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Mandeep Dillon.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Sam Sharp. Darren Garrett.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Joan Clendenin. We have a quorum.
Yeah, Joan's here. She is. Yeah.
Are there any announcements?
Who's the guy sitting next to you?
This guy?
We need an introduction.
I suppose we do. This is our new board-approved member of the public. And Mr. Garrett, would you like to introduce yourself to the group?
Yes, my name is Darren Garrett, and all I can say is glad to be back, and I'm very honored to have been appointed by the Board of Supervisors and given their trust to represent not only themselves but the public and the taxpayers at large. And I'm excited, so thank you all very much. And a particular thanks to Trustee Jim DeMartini.
Good choice.
We're going to need that gift back from you.
I almost brought it with me.
I have one announcement to make. At the last 12th Street Management Committee meeting, the county decided not to move forward with the window cleaning, to remove the wires and bury them and go underneath. They cited unknown costs, that they were just unsure that there wouldn't be any additional costs behind the MID proposal. They also cited uncertainty regarding what's underneath the ground, gas lines and so forth. So that was the decision that was made.
The other sides of the building will be washed in the next month or so. Just not that back one. In order to wash that side, we're going to have to turn off the power and do the whole thing. So we'll have to get bids on that and move forward. So public comment. Oh, I guess I should ask, are there any more comments or announcements? Okay, so public comment. No members of the public, so we'll move on from there. Consent items. Does anyone need to pull any consent items? Is there a motion to accept the consent items?
Motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Moving on from there. The investments. Investment Manager Annual Presentation. Capital Prospects.
Exclusively on U.S. emerging managers.
And the assets under management, which are listed at the last bullet on that page, at the end of May on a preliminary basis, we're about $1.1 billion, six client relationships, which are all public pension funds. The nature of the assignments we have are listed below with the dollar amounts and number of accounts. The one change since the last time we reported to the board, the Russell 2500 is a new assignment that we have on behalf of the city of Memphis. And as you may remember from times we've talked to you in the past, we researched the whole of the U.S. equity universe of types of strategies and managers. So we're at all of our client assignments are separate accounts, as yours is, and so we can build kind of anything within that framework. So the Russell 2500 was a new account that was funded in January of this year. We have two opportunities we're working on currently, new opportunities, and that's really the state of the business in that regard. As an update, we have upgraded our systems. We have undertaken a few enhancements on the analytic packages that we use to do the work that we do for you. We had been using the Thompson suite of products since the inception of the firm 13 years ago, and the technology just was not keeping up from our perspective. And so we have moved to the Northfield U.S. Fundamental Risk Model as one component, and the other component is a firm called Investment Metrics, which is a platform that kind of pulls together an array of both holdings-based and returns-based analytics that we're using. So we did that in the fourth quarter of last year, which led to our quarterly reports for you getting out a little late at the end of the year, but we caught up for the first quarter, and things are pretty well put together at this point. So over to page two, it's just a profile of our clients. It's really, we're sometimes asked about the kind of size of clients that we work with, so it's not just the allocation capital prospects has been given, but what size the plans are. And so also the duration, that's just a snapshot of all this business. You're listed down as number five as it is on this list. January of 2009, which we always remind you, it's important to remind you that you all had the strength of your convictions to fund a new program at that point in time, and you have reaped the benefits of some strong absolute numbers since that. You caught almost the bottom of the crisis period before things turned around. This is what the profile of the business looks like today. We're very proud of the work that we do with our clients. We're also really happy that we do have our first client, so we have gone past the 10-year mark on the assignment with the state of Connecticut, which is number three on this list. As far as people are concerned, over to page three, this is the team, as I think you know them. The person to point out on the list is Karen Meyer, who's in the second row to the right. She's the next most senior person at the firm after Liz and myself. Liz and I have been partners since the early 1980s and have worked together a long time. Claudia and Joan that you see here did work with us at our former employer. Karen's newer to us. She will have completed her fourth year here in a couple weeks, and very well credentialed and well experienced, and she's growing into the role that she has here at Capital Prospects, which is one of the benefits we have to being a small organization. Our experience is down at the bottom. The numbers just get bigger every time we report to you. Nothing much else changes. And our brief biographies are on page four, if you want to take a look at any of that, or you know, Karen's credentials, as I mentioned. So with that, are there any questions on the organization? I feel like I'm flying along here. It's kind of hard to do this when we can't look at each other. I always say that, too. Anything we could answer for you?
Nope. Looks like we're good.
Okay. Very good. Well, then I'll hand it over to Liz, who will talk a little bit about the research universe, and we'll get into the program in a minute.
Well, other than what Marilyn mentioned about the new analytics platforms that we're using, there really isn't anything that's changed about how we go about constructing programs and doing our research and putting
putting those things in place. And the material that's in here on the underlying research universe and the investment process itself is the same as it's been. I'd be happy to go through it, or as nothing's changed, if you'd rather just skip over to the small cap value program itself, we can do that.
How about the latter?
Okay. That's perfect. So we go over to page 13, which would start the program review. This is a page that you've seen from us before, just updated, which I think is always important to go back and look. Not only we will get to performance in a minute, which we've been very pleased with, but to tell you, to translate it into what the dollars look like. With the funding date of Jan 109, as I say, at about $49 million, there have been capital calls, cash flows out of the program over the intervening years, ending the end of April here with $83 million in the portfolio. So I think it's important to just, you know, root ourselves back to what the absolute dollars have been here as well. The roster that you see to the right, the team of six managers, there have been no changes to that team. Recently, the only ones that have ever taken place in the program at all are listed at the bottom of the page, which related to a portfolio manager's move. But otherwise, the portfolio team has been stable, and you see what the dollar amounts and the allocation to each manager is listed there to the right of the page. So going over to page 14, just some investment characteristics. Again, nothing really has changed. You know, we have a mix of managers that we kind of look at as a core position, and some other managers around that core with more eclectic, if you will, approaches. We think that the program is well diversified. Our goal is to give exposure to all of the underlying components of the benchmark. I think in terms of general characteristics, the managers we've selected have always tended to favor higher quality, so there is more of a quality bias in the portfolio. We don't manage the portfolio to come out this way, but we're happy when we see that the PEG ratio, forecast growth, and PE is at a discount to the benchmark. We think this means that the managers are finding favorable prospects in the companies they invest in that in aggregate reflect good value with lower valuation relative to the market. And the program has continued to exhibit a more of a moderate risk level in terms of tracking error, which we are pleased about. It has gone up a little bit in the last year, but it's still within a band that we consider to be quite moderate. Next couple of pages just show the sector allocation. I compared this to the aggregate of the portfolio versus benchmark a year ago, and it is pretty much exactly the same. You know, we have typically been underweighted in the financial sector and overweighted in the industrials and technology and consumer discretionary areas. Those four sectors comprise the lion's share, about 3/4 of the benchmark and the portfolio as well. So the characteristics really haven't changed either. We have the top 10 holdings. And then on page 17, the performance of the program. So in aggregate, the program is still well ahead of the benchmark since inception. Before fees, the outperformance has been 334 basis points annualized. We are very satisfied with this level and satisfied with the managers as well. It's been a much more challenging environment more recently, actually kind of going back to about 2014, 2015 was a tough year for active managers generally, and you know, we, and that has continued into 2016 as well, although we have been able to stay ahead of the benchmark. It's you know, the managers in the program have generally been kind of pro-economic recovery, and it's been an environment that at some point has favored that, but on a macro basis, it's really paid to be much more defensive. So there have been headwinds to face, and last year was, you know, comparisons were not as strong as they had been previously, but we still believe that in an environment where we feel that it's more normalized, if you will, less macro-driven, more the type of environment where investors are paying attention to underlying fundamentals and are rational in terms of valuation, that the managers that we have in the program will continue to do well. Basically, they have all done well. Keeley, a little bit more difficult environment for what they've been doing in terms of restructuring ideas and complex ones at that, and the market in the type of environment we've been in has not been particularly hospitable to more complex situations, preferring things that are a little bit more easy to understand. But we, you know, we feel that the managers all have contributed to the good results from an attribution standpoint. It's, the stock selection is the key driver, and over the entire time frame, the industrials, energy, technology, materials, and financials areas have been sources of the greatest contribution from stock selection. In addition, underweighting energy and underweighting financials have been other notable positives. The in terms of things that have been more detractors, a tilt towards the higher end of lower cap and favoring lower dividend yield when higher dividend yield has been really a favored factor in the market has been has posed challenges, but on balance, we're very happy with the way the program is structured and the way the individual managers are performing and the dynamics of the managers against each other. So that's kind of an overall summary. Be happy to answer any questions.
Hey, Liz.
Yeah.
This is Rick. Hi. Pacific Ridge Microcap Value Managers, they look like they really have been blowing away the benchmark. Is that mostly attributable to stock selection as well?
It is. And they, if you look at their attribution over the entire time period that they've been in the program, there are several sectors that stand out, notably technology, industrials, materials and energy, plus an underweight in energy, and that has come from they've done very, very well.
Thank you.
There's the pages that follow wrap the book up. There's a little narrative on each of the managers, including Pacific Ridge, who's kind of what they're how they do what they do, just in a brief paragraph for each of the managers.
A question on page number 17, the 1 year mark, the benchmark was slightly better. That has not been the case before. Is there a reason for that?
I'm very sorry, we had trouble hearing the question.
So your 1 year, on page 17, the 1 year, composite return?
Yes.
It's the benchmark is slightly better than that. That has not been the case before. if you look at the 3 years, 5 years, and since inception, is there a reason for that?
I think it's, you know, the difficulty of that 12-month period, as I said, 2015 had, you know, a number of challenges in it. I think it's mostly where it falls. I couldn't tell you specifically, you know, which months within that 12-month, one-year period were more challenging, but you know, we've just been in an environment when there's a lot of back and forth, so we haven't outperformed, you know, every single month. Yeah, so this is a period that captures, you know, some of the difficulties, certainly the end of last year. The end of 2015 and into 16, so that number would reflect the 12-month period ending April of 2016. So it's really just a matter of what that measurement period was and what took place in certain of the months that led to the comparison not being favorable compared to the other periods that you mentioned.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question. Liz, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. This is Ed Hoffman from Barris. I had a question for you on page 12. You highlight the two new systems. Can you tell us about how those might improve your process or change your process or what they allow you to do differently? And if you expect that to result in any changes to your portfolio?
Well, the important thing to mention is that in terms of functionality, the nature of what each of the components of the new systems do, there's nothing different from what we were getting under the Thompson suite. The Northfield risk model permits us to look at the portfolios. Maybe I'll take a step back. The way we construct a program such as yours starts out when we're building with looking at what each of the portfolios looks like in combination with the managers. When we're testing teams of managers, we're looking at it at the portfolio level up. And as Liz said, we're trying to get exposure across the component parts of the benchmark. The risk model also allows us to look at factor exposures. There's different measures that we look at to see that what a manager, we believe a manager does, is reflected in the portfolio, and then how that portfolio fits with the others. So that's really what the Northfield model assists us in doing, but it's the same thing that the Vestech under Thompson, the Vestech risk model allowed us to do. What it is kind of a current technology. It's really an enhancement to the actual technology. Vestech was abandoning some of their earlier platforms, and we were not particularly pleased with the new platform. So to answer your question, then investment metrics is a tool that lets us do a lot of different measures all under one roof. We used to also, apart from the Thompson products, have the PerTrack was another system that we had to use to get certain measures, and now everything's kind of under investment metrics in that regard. So it was kind of efficiency for us, but also the technology moving into modern times, if you will. So it's not that there's something new provided in terms of functionality, but the tools are much more robust.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions?
I think that's it then.
All right. Marilyn, Liz,
okay.
Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks, as always, for the confidence you have placed in us. And you certainly know where to find us if there's any follow-on questions you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all.
Are we done with that? Is it disconnected?
No, I believe Raven is on the line for our next one.
Okay, you're already on.
We are.
There you go. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, you have the ear of the Stansera Retirement Board.
Okay. Well, you've got Josh Green, Portfolio Manager and Founder of Raven on the phone, and Tom Chivetta, Director of IR. and marketing for Raven. You should have a presentation. It's about a 7-page PowerPoint. I'd like to use that as a basis for this discussion. I am open to questions throughout. Tom and I will tackle this in tandem, but feel free, even though we're on the conference call, just to speak up and stop us if you feel you need additional detail at any time. I'm going to start on page 3 just to give you an overview of what we are going to talk about this afternoon. A lot has changed at Raven for the positive since you made your initial investment in Fund 1, and I will give you a detailed review of the status of the management company. You are investors in 2 of our 3 funds, both Fund 1 and our most recent fund, Fund 3, and therefore we'll give you an update on both of those. I'll go into some detail about the growth of the investment team, so we can demonstrate the application of resources and growth in conjunction with growth of the firm overall. And I want to spend some time at the end discussing the sourcing of investments, because that is going to be the number one differentiating factor between Raven's strategy and other competitors in the space. But to start from the top, I'm moving to page 4 now, set the table. You should all remember that Raven is a private equity firm and registered investment advisor that does really 2 things and only 2 things. We either make loans to companies secured by the assets of those companies, or we acquire assets outright. That's all we do. The key to that business is that we do it through direct lending, which is primary origination, meaning we go out and source all of our own investments. We do apply a detailed underwriting process that is adapted from my experience at Merrill Lynch from 1998 to 2008. And we manage our assets that we invest in directly, which means that we are very active in the day-to-day management of each investment, and therefore are active in seeking the disposition of those assets as well. Our management company, was formed just prior to the launch of our first fund, and we have been adding personnel as our AUM has grown. In 2 slides, I'll show you a org chart of the current company. But we have always taken the tack that we would build the business around the AUM that we manage, rather than building a team and then seeking AUM around the team. And I think that's an important point, which is that we've never said that we need to raise a certain amount of assets in order to pay ourselves a certain amount of money. We've done it the opposite way. We've always said we're going to align ourselves with our investors and grow our team over time in a prudent manner, and we've done that. We have added additional resources to our operations team over the last year. Initially, when we were a small team, we had a controller. Now we have a controller, CFO, a portfolio manager, and a junior operations person. So we've been beefing up our controls as our AUM grows so that we can be responsive to investor inquiry. We have had an amazing amount of continuity with our service providers at the firm. I think that's a pretty important facet of what we do. So our administrators remain the same, legal counsel, et cetera, it's all stayed the same. That's given us the benefit of focusing on deployment of capital as opposed to organizing the structure around our firm. So the firm investment activity and AUM, summary, I'm going to have Tom just talk over a macro in terms of how the size of the firm and what our LP constituent looks like, and then I'll get back into some detail over deal flow and pipeline. I'm going to hand off to you, Tom.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. So first, the AUM of the firm currently sits at $542 million. That includes, which I'll touch on a little bit in further detail later, Fund 3, which currently is at $330 million of AUM, of which you are a $50 million investment in that. The two funds that you have invested in represent 75% of the firm's AUM, just for the record. We have, in Fund 3, we have 22 investors, and about 36% of it is pension plans, 48% of it is foundations and endowments, 12% is wealth funds, and the remaining are private clients, the GP and family and friends, if you will. So we're in a very good, we had also for Fund 3 a very strong re-up of prior investors comprising over $200 million of our $330 million for the capital raise for Fund 3 so far. I'll come back to that in a little bit.
Okay. So let me take it back from Tom now and talk a little bit about the type of deal flow, the amount of deal flow we're seeing, and give you an update on our pipeline. We started tracking every lead that would come into a Raven deal professional starting with the launch of our third fund in July of last year. And the amount of opportunities that we're seeing has required us to bifurcate our pipeline structure. Historically, we would aggregate opportunities that come into the firm either through cold calls from interested borrowers or sellers of assets, or from proactive steps that the deal professionals were taking to source new opportunities. And we would aggregate those opportunities, add them to a pipeline report, and we would meet weekly as a team to discuss the merit of the opportunity and allocate the investment to a particular deal professional. Over the last few years, now I will get into some detail as to what's going on in the market in a minute, but the amount of origination has gotten so significant that we've had to create what we call a lead sheet, which aggregates all investments that we are seeing. And then from the lead sheet, we have to do a further analysis to add investments to our pipeline. The relevance is that we're seeing more deal flow than we can process at the moment, and therefore we're adding resources to help us underwrite those opportunities. But it's important to know that our pull-through rate, and this is a good thing, it really starts to focus on the best and most attractive opportunities that we're seeing. And so we are not in the market today desperately seeking out opportunities that don't fit our mandate. We have the luxury at the moment of being highly selective in what we're seeing. And we're going to show you a chart in a few minutes that actually lays out just the mass volume of deal flow that we're seeing. The reason there's so much deal flow in the marketplace is partially due to the maturity of the platform of Raven, which means the market now recognizes Raven as a robust and viable lender, as well as asset acquirer, and therefore our name is out in the market, and therefore we are seeing increased deal flow. A similar occurrence happened when I was running the principal investment group at Merrill Lynch, but Merrill Lynch obviously has a much more branded name than we do, and so it took us a couple of years to be in the marketplace for us to be recognized as a potential lender. There have been a number of additional entrants into our marketplace, meaning when we started talking to you back in 2011 and 2012, direct lending was still considered a relatively new asset type, but that has changed as rates have remained low and investors are seeking yield products that aren't necessarily driven by a weaker credit or taking additional risk exposure. So the idea behind direct lending is to identify companies that have strong assets, strong balance sheets, that may be smaller in size than some of the more low products in the credit markets, but to go directly to those companies and create a customized product for them. And that customization and the idea that you're going directly to the company creates an opportunity for the lender to charge a higher interest rate because there's no cost or friction to going to the market, and there's a value to the customization of the direct lending product. But that market has seen new entrants. Those new entrants oftentimes were sponsored by larger private equity firms that are brand names in the marketplace, such as Carlyle, Apollo, Ares. And as a result, there has been an additional consolidation of these new entrants just over the last year or so, meaning the competition at the larger levels of direct lending has gotten so intense that you're starting to see larger market players consolidate into one another. And that has driven the most attractive deal sizes for these competitors to exceed $100 million per loan size for asset acquisition. And so these firms are large, they're well capitalized, and they're seeking larger size deals than we would historically have raised. We like to focus on investments of between $5 million and $35 million. So we are not seeing at the Lehman level a significant amount of competition from these larger players, and that is also driving origination towards us. So that's a good thing. If we were to grow the size of the firm much larger, meaning increase the target AUM of Fund 3, which we won't do because Fund 3 is now fully raised, or were we to set our targets in our next subsequent fund at a level of $750 million to $1 billion, that would bring us into the same arena as these larger players. And we feel that the most value we can add for our investors is by remaining small and seeking out these smaller opportunities that have less competition. The recent activity of our firm and my investment thesis within Raven itself has shifted as interest rates have remained historically low, and volatility until recently has started to become less a factor in the markets. That has caused us to start looking for opportunities that are really core to our key investment strategy, which is to seek out those loan opportunities that are not going to be easily replicated by banks, specialty finance companies, or other potential private equity firms. And those might include loans secured by intellectual property assets, certain types of receivables. In one case, we made a recent investment that was an asset-based loan secured by cell phone towers and cell phone tower equipment and contracts from major carriers. And what this means is that we have de-emphasized investing in those asset types that can be replicated by larger platforms, such as transportation assets like aircraft, rail cars, and real estate. Those areas are highly competitive at the moment and are yielding returns that are far below our targeted return. So one of the nice things that we can do at Raven is we focus on five different discrete asset types. As markets shift and cycles continue, we can make a conscious decision to focus on certain asset types that are less well seen in the marketplace and therefore still continue to drive our investment returns without taking on additional risk. And that was a conscious decision by the firm about 14 months ago we sat down as a team and discussed where we thought the best opportunities were going to be for Fund 3. That being said, we have, moving on, we have exposure to shipping assets in all of our funds, actually, Fund 1, Fund 2, and Fund 3. We invest in a very specific type of shipping vessel called a bulker vessel. It's known to carry commodities in international trade. It can carry everything from iron ore, coal, and other finished iron products to foodstuffs such as grain and oils. And we like the bulker market because it offers us an opportunity to get a hard asset, which is the vessel, and a revenue stream from a lease contract from a charter party. And we have been actively investing in bulkers since Fund 1, 2012. We just completed the acquisition of our third vessel in Fund 3. And the shipping industry is depressed overall in the marketplace. It is ripe for recovery. And we see this as an excellent opportunity to own an asset that has not only income-generating potential, as I mentioned, but also the prospect of residual value when it comes time to exit the investment. From a, what it's worth, from a trivia standpoint, the first vessel we acquired is named the Soho Merchant. That vessel is docking in Los Angeles in 2 weeks, so it's the first time it's made a visit to the West Coast of the United States, and I think several members of our investment team will be going out to the vessel and meeting with the team to look at the ship here in LA. We think that the shipping industry will turn and become a positive investment within the next 3 to 5 years. We are fortunate to have duration at the Raven Funds. And so while we look for the market to recover, we also will continue to earn the revenue stream from the charter rates because our vessels remain employed cycle to cycle. The last bit on affirmative investment activity and AUM overview is our credit fund. And this is a different product that one of our investors asked us to create for them specifically. So it's currently a $60 million alternate investment vehicle. It doesn't compete with Raven Funds 1, 2, and 3. It is designed to effectively soak up investment declinations from the core fund, which means because we have so much deal flow, if an investment doesn't meet our investment parameters from a return profile, meaning mid to high teens, but the asset still has the appropriate risk level, we have the opportunity to make an investment against that asset at a much lower total return for our investors. And that, just to give you an idea, that return could be anywhere from 8% to 12%. It's much lower than our targeted return for our core fund.
Hey, Josh, can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
Obviously, Raven feels very very good about these Ultramax vessel investments. Why not just buy another one for Fund 3? Why are you doing it? Are you worried about overexposure in that fund?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there is the shipping market is interesting. It's slightly different than a lot of the other investments we make because we see shipping opportunities pretty much every week that are exactly the same as our existing investment, meaning we could go into the market and acquire the same vessel type that we have already acquired for Fund 3. And therefore just effectively double our risk in that investment. Keep in mind, we don't use any leverage risk in these investments, so these are unlevered returns. So it is a little different that there is a viable market to acquire these assets on a regular basis. But my thesis is as follows. We think that the true value of these vessels is somewhere between $25 to $35 million, and that's a direct correlation to the amount of charter fees you can charge the counterparty that's using your vessel to move the goods. At a $300-plus million fund, I am confident that when this investment realizes, it will already contribute a significant amount to the total AUM of the firm. And I'm at the price that we were able to acquire our third vessel, which is by far the most attractive price we've ever been able to achieve in the acquisition of a vessel. In fact, the ultimate purchase price that we settled on for the Fund 3 vessel was $5 million less than the initial contract price that we acquired initially. So I feel like we've gotten a very, very good deal on our hands with this vessel. If it was the market was more normalized, we would have to end up paying a significant amount more for the vessel we have in Fund 3. And I am comfortable owning just one vessel in the fund. I do not want Raven as a fund to be so concentrated in any one particular investment, be it aircraft, receivables, real estate, IP. I really want to make sure that as we go through that you can see the diversification by appetite. And I think that this ship investment will end up being about a 10% value of the fund overall. And that will give us the nice diversification across appetite.
Fair enough. Okay.
Okay. I think, Rick, I'm just add one other point. I think you remember when we first discussed putting you back in 2012, I'm pretty sure I said that even if we found an investment that was so attractive for the firm that it would effectively utilize the full AUM of the fund, we would not deploy more than a certain amount in any particular asset from a concentration perspective. If we did see something like that, we would put a fixed amount in the fund and offer the overage to our investors as a co-investment so as not to alter the diversification of the investments in the fund.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on to page five of the presentation, I'm going to hand off to Tom again. We're going to talk about Fund 1 and Fund 3 and a general overview. And then he'll hand it back to me as we do with some highlights of the two funds.
So just a brief overview, an update looking back at
we lose you?
Hello. We lost Tom. All right. And when he gets back online, I'll step in. Tom, we're going to go through the percentage of capital committed and deployed for Fund 1. We've already been over this in prior meetings, but Fund 1 closed just over $150 million of committed capital, and we were able to invest an amount that was in excess of $150 million. Because if you remember, we have the ability to recycle principal during the investment phase of our funds. Meaning if we receive principal back during the first, in Fund 1 case, during the first 2 years, we can reinvest that capital into new investments, thereby effectively turning the capital over more than once. And we were able to do that in Fund 1. So Fund 1 was fully deployed. Tom's going to we'll have to give the remaining actual figures for the net asset value. I don't have that with me at my fingertips. But I will tell you that Fund 1 is deep into its realization phase, meaning that we are beginning to exit the investments of Fund 1 in a fairly rapid fashion. And we have recently just exited our investment in our aircraft that we acquired back in 2012. If you remember, Raven acquired two A320 aircraft that were on lease to a commercial airline. Those aircraft were acquired at a very attractive price, and we were able to generate current income on those aircraft by leasing them to a commercial aviation partner. And then recently, given our view of the used aircraft market, we deemed it prudent to sell the aircraft. So we marketed our aircraft for sale back at the end of last year, beginning of this year. And we recently closed on that investment within the last few weeks. That distribution will be coming back to Samsara in the next few weeks. But the return profile for the acquisition of a hard asset with current income is generally at about a 14%+ return and about a 1.4x return on capital. A really successful investment for us and one that we're pretty happy about. To give you a sense of the dollar terms, the investment was initially a $23 million investment, and we'll be returning proceeds north of 30 on that, well north of 30. The other highlight to Fund 1 at the moment, I mean, you have, we've reported on other realizations in the fund. These are just the one, these are just the realizations that are occurring now. We have some good news to report on our investment in coal. So we might be the only investment firm that has good news with respect to its investment in coal, but we invested in a very specific type of coal that is used to create silicon, and as a result, it is in very high demand. It is very expensive in relation to other types of stoker and met coal. It generally trades at 2.5 times the price of regular coal. And our mine is now highly profitable and has been entering into contract with the largest users of the silicon-driven coal over the last year. They've gone back to the equity market privately to raise more equity to buy more equipment so they can generate even more coal. And so we would look for this investment. It was initially an $18 million investment in Fund 1. We would look to exit that investment within the next year. And I'm happy to report that things are going quite well for that kind of investment. The reason why I touch on the aircraft and our coal investment is because on a combined basis, they make up a large portion of the remaining assets of Fund 1.
Hey, Josh, it's Rick again.
Yes.
We can take this offline later, but do you have a pretty good idea of projected cash flows from Fund 1 over the next 6 months to a year?
Yes, we definitely do. I would prefer to do that offline with
right.
you, but I will ask Chris to run those numbers for you.
Okay.
You will get a very good sense of the capital that will be coming back to you over the next 6 to 12 months.
Okay, thanks.
Good. So, Tom, you're back, it sounds like, which is good. So, if you could do me a favor, the one number I didn't have at my fingertips was the remaining net asset value of Fund 1.
It is $4 million, and that is including or excluding the A320s, meaning that's the value after the sale reduction in asset value of the A320s.
Can you repeat that?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can you repeat that number again?
It's 4 million.
I still can't get it.
Say it again.
74.
74 million?
Yes.
And that's down from $153 million, I believe. That's correct.
That's right.
Okay. So, Dr. Ken, can you review Fund 3, the allocation in terms of our most recent fund close?
Yes, I'm having a connection difficulty. So, Fund 3, to begin with, the target investment that this is for us to invest on an individual investment basis between $5 million. That's been consistent. Fund one and three, as have been the target returns of 14% to 18% gross. We would expect to invest approximately $400 to $450 million. That includes recycle. We have a well, the section refers to a three-year investment period for fund three, with the right to recycle during that period. So invest during the three-year investment period, which we are now 1 year into it, and we receive capital back, we would actually recycle the pool while distributing profits back to investors. We expect Fund 3 to approximate 60% in investments in loans, 40% in purchase of assets, and that is kind of on par with how we have viewed the business over the long term. From a fundraising perspective, we went out with a $350 million hard cap, a $300 million target. We are at $330 million of commitment. We are basically oversold. Back in April and May, we started telling prospects and people that wanted to invest in some reasonably large amount that we were out of capacity. And we had $20 million remaining, which one investor had taken a commitment to at this point. And so we had reached our hard cap, and are very pleased with the process that both was efficient and really helped the deal team to continue to focus on their activities of sourcing and structuring deals throughout the process. So that's been a successful operation for us to efficiently raise this capital with a lot of commitment from, as I mentioned, our existing investor base, which we thank you for again, and a nice addition of several significant institutional investors into our family, if you will. Any questions so far?
Any questions?
Good.
No, we're good.
Okay, good. Let's go to page 6 if we can. And just to show you, I don't want to harp on this, but you guys were instrumental in effectively launching RavenNet as a business. When you invested initially, I believe our team was four investment professionals. We've grown quite a bit over the last several years, but again, it has not been wild growth. And so if you look here, we have the right team in place to execute this business plan. We have had remarkable continuity at the firm. The investment professionals that joined me from Merrill Lynch initially, Jeremy Tucker, James Mattiello, and Brandon Dorr, have all remained constant, which is really a testament to what we're trying to accomplish at the firm. We've added Dimitri Cohen recently from a credit investment firm in Boston, has recently joined us in the last 6 months. And we've started to build out, as I mentioned, our operations team, which I think is a really important component as we grow our assets to make sure that we have the reporting and control capabilities in place. So Chris Felice is our chief financial officer, and we've built a small team underneath him. And I can see that team growing in the future as well.
I have a question. Do you have legal? Who does your legal work?
So we use outside legal at the firm for a number of different reasons. First, we always use external legal counsel at Merrill Lynch when I was investing principal portfolio there. But what we found is it's very hard to find attorneys that are experts in every aspect of fund investment. So we use certain firms to handle our fund administration,
the LLC agreements, the administration of the management company, et cetera. And then we have always used outside counsel for the individual deals that we invest in, because we found that certain firms have better departments that relate to transportation. In transportation, you have attorneys that are well-versed in shipping versus aviation, et cetera. So we have a small stable of law firms that we've been using over the years. Several of them have been working with the principals that were given, certainly in my case, since the late 90s. But we haven't hired in-house counsel. Instead, we've used Stewart & Kinsel as our outside advisor for the management company.
Thank you.
Why are some of these lines dotted on your personnel chart and some not?
So that has to do with the direct reporting structure, meaning as our firm has grown, I am still responsible for all of the investment professionals. But if you see the junior staff at Raven, which today is comprised of Matt Sidari and Joe Ma, they report in almost a pool function to the investment professionals, with Jeremy Tucker being their direct report. So we are trying to stratify the reporting structure slightly so that I don't have to be directly on top of the junior professionals. And that's consistent with how investment banking operations would be run at a larger firm. So I guess it's a good pickup on your part. I'm not trying to overcomplicate how I do things at Raven, but the idea is to sort of break up the responsibilities for reporting so that I'm not necessarily directly handling the junior employees at all times.
All right, thank you.
So on page 7, this is probably my favorite slide of the presentation. Luckily, it's the last page. This just shows you, and these are real numbers that we're reporting on page 7. If you look at the upside down pyramid, you'll see that since July 1 of last year, and this is directly in relation to Fund 3, which is the current fund that we're deploying, we've seen 228 different distinct leads come into the firm, which totaled in volume over $4 billion of opportunities. Now, I should note that when an investment lead comes into the firm, if it was a $100 million investment opportunity, it's impossible for us to be able to execute that investment within the firm due to our concentration limits. But we would then ultimately cap that opportunity at $50 million for purposes of tracking it, because we could potentially do an investment of $35 million and then offer $15 million out to co-investment for our investor base. But this just shows you just the mass amount of deal flow coming into Raven, and the fact that we've executed, out of 228 different opportunities, 8 leads. That's it, 8 deals were closed out of 228. That doesn't mean we're not focusing on the investments, that we're not getting our work done. It means that we're being highly selective in the type of investments that we're seeking to put into Fund 3. And because we have time to deploy the fund, which is a part of our investment period, we will not only be able to build a portfolio that we can stand by, but we'll also find really the best opportunity in that fund. And that continues today. Right now in our pipeline, there are a handful of investments that are closing. So I would say by the end of September, we'll have somewhere between 10 and 12 investments in the portfolio. Over the entire portfolio of Fund 3, we can expect somewhere between 20 and 25 total investments maximum. So we are well on our way to deploying our third fund. The deal flow, as I mentioned, being so important for what we do, does not come from brokers, and it certainly does not come from private equity firms that take control stakes in companies and then look to lever those companies with debt. We avoid those opportunities completely. It comes from former clients of ours, either at Merrill Lynch or now at Raven, clients that would be companies, either the president, the CFO, treasurer of the company would be our client, or they would move on to a new business and then reach out to Raven for financing. previous co-investors with the other players in the marketplace that focus on potentially larger deal sizes. We'll often get an inquiry from them seeing if we would be interested in working on smaller deals, which we are. And we found a very fruitful source of origination from former investment bankers at large sort of white shoe investment firms based in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. We found that a number of those investment professionals have moved to more local regions, set up smaller boutique investment firms, and they are the ideal source of origination for Raven because they cover smaller middle market companies that are seeking investments of somewhere between 5 and 35 million. So we're in the very good position vis-a-vis the origination side of the business, and we are going to have to work, like I said, over the next 2 years to deploy this fund. And I think we will be able to do that quite successfully. So I want to thank you for your time today. I'm sorry I'm not there in person. I'm always happy to come see you. If that ever changes, let me know, Rick. I'm happy to come stop by and see you in person. I can't thank you all enough for your support of my firm. Like I said, you really helped put us in business initially back in 2012, and I value your partnership very, very severely, very, very seriously. So thank you again, and if there's anything that comes out of this you need to follow up on, feel free to reach out to myself or Tom, and we will get back to you as soon as possible.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Okay, thank you.
As much as I love how selective they are, it would be nice if they would get on with it so we weren't paying fees on funds that we have no return on. Two more years to deploy all
through
the funds.
Through the investment period.
Seems like... Okay, Executive Director Investment, no items. Varis Investment Consultant, May Flash Report.
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'll try to keep this brief. So you have the May flash report in front of you. Thanks to Brexit, you can throw this out. But we saw some recovery continuing from the April recovery into May. And so generally, we're seeing the equity markets here in the U.S. up, international equity down a touch, U.S. fixed income basically flat, and then we have the real estate and longer-term holdings, which are tough to really get an accurate gauge on a monthly basis, but that gives you a sense for where we are. Heading into June then, the international markets started to ramp up nicely as the thought was Brexit was not going to happen, and then obviously we have the sell-off afterwards. So as a result of that, come Brexit time, I asked my team to take a look at the account values and see where we were prior to, so that we will have a basis of comparison by the end of June. So taking a look at the custodian data on site, the total fund as of June 23rd, the day before, was 1.793, almost 1.794 million. So that's up from here. You can see on this, the top line is 1.766. As of the 27th, so today's the 28th, so that was yesterday, the total fund was down to about 1.709. or 1.710. So roughly speaking, that's a loss through yesterday of about 4.68%, so not quite 5% total fund level. And today we had a bit of a recovery, so hopefully it's not as bad. So we'll see how it finally pans out. But you know, for one thing we know is volatility has re-entered the market, and while the dust settles, hopefully there will be some buying opportunities, and our active managers will get those opportunities to capitalize on them for us. And I think this kind of volatility also fits in nicely with why we adopted the asset allocation we did in the first place of FFP 6-year, thinking that volatility is key and let's figure out how to manage it better. Okay, another follow-up from our last meeting was we had a presentation from Jackson Square. Gordon, if I could ask you to take one of the pass. And we have a handout. The question that came up was, with regard to Jackson Square investing in Valiant as a growth stock, Valiant coming off pretty significantly, and they decided to invest more. And the change in the investment thesis was kind of interesting because it's not really a growth stock anymore. It's more of a value play, perhaps. So we wanted to take a look at it. And the question, and I believe Donna was the one who raised it, was, has this changed what Jackson Square is doing in terms of being our large cap growth manager? Do you have enough?
Sure, it's all right.
Are we sure?
She's got two. She was.
Why don't you restate your hypothesis?
Okay.
Sorry.
So Jackson Square, in terms of their Valiant position and what appeared to originally be a growth story turned into more of a value play, which then turned into a value trap, raised the question, are they sticking to their knitting? Are they being the large cap growth manager we thought we hired? And page two shows a historical style consistency chart. And so you can see that the way these charts work is that a larger dot is representative of a more current portfolio. A smaller bubble is more representative of an older portfolio. And so what we did was we took the six-month rolling windows from 2005 to current to see, are they staying consistent? Indeed, they are. So they make these calls every once in a while like a Valiant. Sometimes they work out, and we are either none the wiser or quite happy, and happiness doesn't lead to any pain, so that kind of moves on. This one was a little more painful, but it still looks like they're sticking to their knitting.
Thank you.
The other question that was raised was with regard to Jackson Square's performance report and the Verus performance report, both having attribution analysis but having numbers that don't jive. Well, it turns out that attribution analyses are really sensitive to some inputs like cash flows and weightings. And so when we take a look at the weightings and making sure that we're looking at it on a trade-weighted basis or a settlement date-weighted basis, if we're capturing every day or just capturing end of month, these things can really throw the numbers off. But the key difference between their report and the Verus report is that they are looking at their performance relative to the index. We are looking at it on an absolute basis. And so some of the numbers do tie out. For example, Allergan is one of their top five detractors, resulting in negative 78 basis points. And that is consistent down below with the Verus report. It's this page. It's the handout, page two. Also negative 78 basis points. So absolute and relative are the same because Allergan is not in the index. So it's not the same. Whereas Valiant results in different numbers. But we went through the exercise to tie it out, and we are using monthly data. They're using daily data. They're using it against their benchmark. We're using it just on absolute basis. And so those things do happen, but wanted to make sure that we were consistent and accurate.
Thank you. I appreciate you following up on those. That was really nice.
Good question. Keeps us honest. Okay. The next piece, moving on to the next agenda item, unless there are any questions, is the project plan for the FFP six-year implementation. And so we have a few pages outlining this, including a Gantt chart that has an excruciating level of detail, which was summarized on page 5. But on pages 2 and 3 highlight what we're trying to do here. And so if we start with the second bullet point here, FFP is more than just simply rebalancing the plan because of the direction we're heading in this changes it incorporates, including perhaps staffing changes, which were discussed at the last meeting, and I think that'll probably be an ongoing discussion. Policies, we want to take a look at both the investment policy statement because it will need to be updated with the new asset allocation, but also probably a good time to just take a look at it and say, is this representative of best practices today? Are there better things we can be doing and thinking more efficiently about that and ensuring the proper oversight and compliance? Processes, various processes in terms of how we actually execute our trades. Investment strategy selection, we have a number of searches to conduct. I think the number is 5 or 6. That'll take a lot of time just in terms of how we do that and bringing those to you. And also recognizing that you have limited time and availability. So we want to create a plan that's doable, and we don't want to be here till 10 o'clock any given night. So we'll spread it out smartly. So page 4 has the deliverables by board meeting. So this June 2016, the deliverable is this project plan. July, I'm going to change that deliverable from set tragedy targets to set strategy targets. We want to set targets for our strategies, not our tragedies. August appears to be blank, but we do have quarterly performance, and as you know, it takes a bit of time to go through our quarterly performance books. So I wanted to have that, and also because we're doing a lot of work that's going to start coming to you in September and thereafter. So starting in September, revised investment and procedure policies. That will take some time, I'm sure, for us to coordinate with staff and legal and go through and create some redline versions for you. And then we start the searches for U.S. Treasury and risk parity, and then finalists coming in November. And so this also raises a question just in terms of how you would like to operate on some of these searches, that there are a number of these mandates that we have a focus list for. We have the top 3, 4, 5 candidates that we have gone through the screening processes. We have gone through due diligence questionnaires. We have met with these managers. We have used these managers and their strategies with others. We can bring them to you in a pretty straightforward, easy process, and you can see the analysis and ask the questions, which is a little different than having the managers come out and come and visit you and that kind of thing, which is largely regarded as a dog and pony show. And so we're seeing more and more clients get away from the dog and pony show, but still having the contact point or still having the availability to meet with the managers. So it's kind of a question for the board in terms of how have you liked to do things and how would you like to do things going forward? We don't necessarily need to solve that here today, but happy to hear any thoughts as well.
Well, it's my question, and maybe you can just clarify, where in this calendar are we transferring the money from the rent equities into, and which ones, from which ones, and into the emerging markets, and which ones? Where is that analysis in?
Okay. So that mainly happens with the next strategy targets. So the strategy targets takes it the next layer down from the asset allocation work that we've done into the specifics of the managers. And it starts to think out what is the time frame when we can do these rebalancings. Because if we have to select a manager, select a strategy, that can't happen until we've made that selection. Whereas other things we have in place and we can do it. So we need to start thinking about that. Part of this is also identifying placeholder strategies. And so, for example, we want to have an allocation to private equity. It will take time to build that allocation. It'll take years to build that allocation, similar to private debt, how it takes time for them to call it. So we want to identify placeholder strategies that are liquid alternatives or best approximations for the kind of exposure we want to get. So we'll start identifying that at the next meeting in July and then have the discussion about how that implementation actually takes place and the rebalancing
will occur. So that in July, then you talk about, I want to take X from those equities and transfer them to these equities.
Right.
These are emerging market equities.
That's right.
That happens specifically in July.
The process begins in July. That'll literally take years to complete. So we will need to start the process and then start finding where we can do what and when.
I mean, like, do we sell from some company? We sell our investment in a company here, and we hold the money until we know where to put it over there?
No.
Well, okay, how are we doing
that? That's the coordination issue. So the how do we do that? I don't have the answer to that yet. But, for example, if we wanted to say, we've identified the international equity managers already because they're already in our portfolio, and we can rebalance between them, we can do that. Or we can rebalance between domestic and international equity because we already have those selected, we can do that. We can't allocate to the U.S. Treasury manager yet because we haven't selected that U.S. Treasury manager, so we likely leave it in fixed income, with Dodge and Cox or however we want to do that, and then proceed through there. So that would be the plan I'd bring back in.
So we would say, okay, we want to transfer, $80 million into the other allocation, and we just identify the $80 million, but we don't know exactly where we're going to put it yet because we haven't ferreted that out.
No, that's exactly what we want to do, is figure out exactly where we're going to put it. So there won't be any period where we're holding it in cash. We're not going to sell out and just hold it there. We want to develop a game plan that allows us to move it smartly over time. We don't want to be out of the market, and we want to set, probably have to set interim targets of how we get to where we're going.
But to get to the heart of Mike's question, it is possible, though, that within a month we could be moving assets from a liquid asset class into another liquid asset class.
It is
that
possible.
That could be happening right. Next month.
Yep.
And it's possible it might not happen for a year.
It's possible, that's right. I mean, a lot's going to be predicated on what happens in the markets over the next month or two, right?
A week.
It could be.
These times of turmoil, is it time to get out and stay away, or are these buying opportunities that we should be jumping all over? It's hard to say. But that's why we set the policy, so we don't use our gut instinct on these things, which is traditionally the wrong way to go, just behavioral finance. So this is the outline on page 4. Page 5, then, the Gantt chart. The only thing I want to highlight here is when we take a look at doing a search, line 14, and I know this is kind of small font, so I apologize, but line 14 has one of these searches broken out into the components. So U.S. Treasury. We submit a search request to our manager research group. That's what MRG stands for, manager research group. And they generate the screening list. That creates the search presentation that is brought back to the board. Finalists present to the board for approval, and then we negotiate and execute agreements. So kind of a, five-step process. And then you can see that I've hidden the rows that are similar for each one of these: risk parity, short-term gov credit, private credit, value-add real estate, and private equity fund-to-funds. So that's a lot of work. That's what's going to really take the bulk of the time over the next of the course of the year.
And you're projecting the little timelines over here on the blue, they would project out essentially the same for each one of those: risk parity, private equity.
Generally, yes, and you'll see that some of them end later because we're starting them later, so we can't start them all at the same time. Just in terms of bandwidth.
So is this the practice now? Is this the practice of selecting investment firm or investment manager at this point?
I'd let Rick answer that.
I was thinking what?
So like, what is the current practice of selecting an investment firm? Will this process be any different than what it is now?
It sounds like it could be. In the past, what we've done is normally, I think, what Ed referred to as a dog and pony show, where we had two or three managers come in and talk about their product and what their prospects are from the future, and then they would go away, and this board would vet it. They'd make a preliminary decision, and then we would begin negotiations with that manager to shore up the contract details, and then the board would get the final okay. And that process lasted anywhere from 3 to 6 months in general. But it sounds like you're proposing something a little bit different based on your stable.
Right, right. So we've seen more and more clients get away from that in terms of the efficiency and in terms of a general recognition that, you know, when the managers come to present, we generally see their best salespeople. We don't necessarily see the investment personnel, and we don't necessarily get the best representation of who's the best person to, or company to manage the money for the plan. And so because of that, clients have sort of stepped away and said, you know what, we don't want to see that. We don't want to be biased by that. We don't want to be influenced by the nicest suit or the best haircut kind of thing. We want to get the right manager. And we should have it as a more objective, not subjective, kind of approach that a search allows us to get. So, okay. But that is, you know, if it's a departure from the way you're used to doing things, that may be something that we need to think through. Is that what we want to do or not?
This manager research group, is that the internal group here, or is that like the external service?
That's part of Varis.
That's you guys.
That's okay. Right. Yeah, that's our team in Seattle. Also, some in San Francisco.
Yeah. I'll miss the pony, but wait.
I will not miss the pony.
The dog. The dog's okay.
So this is going to be a fairly long run-out process.
I think we have some pretty full agendas ahead of us, yeah.
I'll throw this out there to the full board. It's not asking for any type of guidance or direction, but I wonder if you would want to consider the creation of an investment committee to go through this process. And again, don't have to answer. It might be something to think about.
It might not be a bad idea since we've gone to the once a month meeting.
Yeah, exactly, because these meetings probably will start to drag on, I would imagine, within the next 3 to 6 months. So it's just something to consider. And if you do, then we can touch up on that subject at a later date.
But Ed, your firm has exposure to everything that we're talking about here for the most part, right?
Great question. Yes, and if we don't, then I would recommend we do an RFP process.
Okay.
And then that would essentially allow us to facilitate what our research group normally does for the traditional asset classes. Everything we have outlined here, we do.
So I think maybe that ties into what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Educate ourselves with a little more exposure through a committee. And it helps you out, I think, as well. It may speed this along a little bit.
Yeah.
Not that I'm looking for more committees, but, you know, every day's a Saturday now, so it's
yeah.
All good.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. So our last item before closed session is Executive Director Administrative, IT Solution.
Okay, very, very briefly let you know what's going on. Kathy's not here, but she gave me some notes to let you know about what's going on in this process. The vendors, we actually went through the vendor conferences a couple weeks ago. We finished those up. Those were very interesting. I don't know if Kathy, I don't think she explained the process last month, but for over the course of 6 days, we had six vendors come in here and actually sit here and listen to, well, we all introduced ourselves and told them where we were going and what our plans were. And then for the entire day, each of these companies were allowed to go out into our office and sit with our staff and ask them questions about our processes. They weren't allowed to take any documents with them home or take any pictures, but they were pretty much able to ask staff whatever questions they want regarding our processes. And the whole intent was to come up with a response to our RFP that was very meaningful and allow them to narrow the scope of the price or the range of the price as narrow as possible, because they were able to eliminate uncertainties in regarding what our work is and what our processes are. So the whole intent is to limit the uncertainty that the vendor has in terms of offering us a price, and that seemed to work very well. Several of the vendors told us that they had never gone through this process before and they thought it was a really good idea. And so I think, I don't know if Jamie, you have anything to add, but I think it turned out to be a very good exercise and a very good use of our time over the course of that week.
It did. It gave us an idea of who we would like to work with as well. I think it helped both sides. They could only ask questions about what we currently do. They could not ask questions about what we would like the system to do. So a lot of them had some really great questions, and we couldn't, like Rick said, they couldn't take anything. They couldn't, they could review everything, they could look at the files, they could measure the file cabinets to see how many, you know, linear feet of files we had. But it was an even field for all of them.
Did you have an initial bid so that you know how much they come off? Or have they not priced anything?
No, not yet.
Now, RFPs are due by this Friday.
Friday, the RFPs will be in here. One of the things that staff was told explicitly not to do was to offer up any more information than what was asked of them, just to keep the playing field level. In other words, we didn't want to say something to one vendor and then not let another vendor know. So staff only responded and answered questions to what was asked of them and nothing more.
It had to be in question form.
Sure, you guys had trouble with that one.
It was difficult, but there were times where we would say, that is not a question.
So anyway, we've gotten through that part of the process. The vendors in the aggregate had roughly 100 additional questions that we posted online. You can see those if you wish with the answers. And as
Jamie alluded to, Friday we'll have all the RFPs in place and we'll begin the process of sifting through mounds and mounds and mounds of paper.
So you guys recorded each of the questions they asked?
I don't believe we did.
And then posted the answers online for all the vendors?
They asked that external to the vendor conference.
Okay. It was directly to Linnea that these questions were asked electronically. And so Linnea answered them with, you know, our help. And so they were generalized questions, but then each vendor could spend time with us.
So if vendor A asked a question and vendor B didn't think to ask the question, vendor A would have the answer, but vendor B wouldn't?
During the vendor conference, but not during the period in time where all of them were allowed to ask Linnea specific questions. If that was the case, we posted all those online for the whole world.
But for the times that they were here.
For the vendor conference, if they didn't ask something that somebody else did, then they're the only ones that got the answer to that question.
Only a couple of them came actually with written questions, so they wouldn't forget anything.
Anyway, that's pretty much it for that.
There's no closed session for me.
Okay, great. So, anything to share?
Like I said before, it's glad to be back. Thank you all. And I just want to add my condolences to the family of the county worker that was recently killed. And also condolences on the death of a retired probation officer, which was Doug Wan. So condolences to that family as well. Yes. So that's all I have.
Nothing for me.
John?
Mike and I are going to make a joint request on behalf of Harold Callahan to put his issue on the agenda for July. He's a retired director of County Public Works, who retired to take care of a sick wife and chose the option not to include her. About a few years later, he married, and he would like his current spouse to be continued on his retirement from Stanislaus County. He was able to do that through work employment from Santa Barbara County before he came to Stanislaus. Mike might want to add more to it than that, but he and I have met with Callahan a couple of times, and it's something I see as an unfortunate circumstance and an unusual circumstance that maybe we could help him out with.
Yeah, did you want to bring that to the Board of Supervisors or Retirement Board?
No, Retirement Board.
Okay. I think ultimately it's going to have to be the county that has to decide whether
right.
they want
We'd
to do
like
this.
We'd like to flush it out here.
Okay.
We wouldn't flush it out before they would.
Right.
This doesn't seem like a deviation from policy. This seems like a deviation from policy based on
some,
a friendship.
There could be some actuarial costs involved here, and I think the county might want to weigh in.
You know anything about it?
No, first I've heard of it.
I don't know.
Okay,
I can bring something. Than I do.
Yeah, it seems like it would be good to have him bring his concerns to staff, and then they can look at, they know what our policy is and what the right steps to go to before it would become a board issue.
Well, but when I talked to you, you suggested that.
No, I thought that what we should do is vet this with the county first, because there could be some actuarial cost to this that I don't know if this board would want to make that decision on behalf of the county. I don't think the cost would be great, Joan, but nonetheless, there probably would be additional cost to this.
Okay.
But you should know the issues before it becomes a board issue, right? I mean, if it can be resolved without becoming a public board issue.
It's a legislative change.
Okay.
So the county board of supervisors would have to decide, we want to offer this benefit
to our retirees, and then we would have the legislation changed to where Stan Sarah would be bound by that section of the law.
Well, would it be a legislative change, or was it just an interpretation of current legislation? Because we're getting it from Santa Barbara.
You know, this is not an agenda item. I think we're probably getting it far from open, you know.
Okay, well, I just need pure direction here. Should I bring something to the board next month, or should we vet this with the county first?
I think we should let the county know first. I'm just saying, because we've had a policy in the past, and if we're going to deviate from that, that needs to start with the county first, I think, because they're the plan sponsor ultimately. They have the exposure. So we can send a request to them.
Okay.
That's fine with me.
I'm sorry.
You want me to have him come?
I think he should.
Well, I've already talked to that guy.
Okay.
Were you under the impression that this board would make that decision?
No.
Okay.
Just... if the Board of Supervisors agrees to go ahead, we have to agree too.
Absolutely.
And the thinking was, let's get the sense of this board before we make the official request.
We can do that.
If we're not going to approve it after the board does it, why go to the board? That was, I thought that was a conversation we had.
Okay.
But we can't make this case specific. We have to make a policy change.
Exactly.
And as I just gone through all this retirement stuff. And I retired from schools and I did it on the state. And you have to put down there on your request to be covered for your spouse. And your benefit is less if she's covered fully. And if you say, no, I need it all now, then you get more money now. The cost of her extension isn't covered. So
that
policy-wise,
sums it up, yeah.
Policy-wise, it could have a significant.
It could.
Not individually, but
So how do we want to proceed? Do we want to put it on an agenda so we can discuss it legitimately, or do we just want to say, let's how do we get it to the board?
I want to know what your pleasure is. We're just deciding right now. Do you need staff to bring something back next month? That's all.
From my standpoint, I don't think it is is appropriate procedure for us to hear it before the plan sponsor would hear it. What it's a hypothetical for us if that happens. If they do this, then we will do this. I mean, that doesn't seem.
Well, that was kind of my first thought. My first thought was that the board, the retirement system, is going to simply say, well, what does the county want to do? We're not going to make a decision on this. That was my first thought.
Okay, so we should tell him to go to talk to the board.
Or we can meet to facilitate a discussion of people who know this stuff and the board.
Why don't you let me work with him and the county together? Let's see where that gets me. I'll get back in touch with him and I'll talk to the county, and maybe I can get the two sides to come together. We can figure out what we want to do.
Okay. That's fine with me. Okay. I just want it to move forward.
I got
it. Just want some movement.
I understand. I do.
Okay.
And there should be a way to sort of people who make
those
decisions.
Yeah.
I mean, sir, we should have, the system should be flexible.
Okay.
Jeff, anything?
Are we going to have a separate agenda item in the future for the due diligence
trip?
Okay.
Yes, next month we'll have a full report out.
Okay, all right then.
Jim?
I don't have anything
today. I will wait to talk about our due diligence trip when it's on the agenda. But Chicago was a very quick trip, very tiring, but it was well worthwhile.
Did you pass while you were there? The mayor has a voting booth in his office.
Didn't see a problem.
I have nothing.
So I attended a trustee roundtable in San Jose, I think earlier this month. Several issues were discussed. One particular one that got my attention was there's some counties, some systems statewide that are undertaking a system upgrade, just like we're now in this process. So there's some good and bad that as a result, of the discussions. There, some systems were having like a cost overrun, so I just wanted to kind of bring that to our attention, you know, as we go through this process of selecting a vendor and so forth. I don't know which particular one. So.
Yeah. We are extraordinarily sensitive to that issue because I've been involved in a project like this before, and some of the other systems have too. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we decided to do this vendor conference, because we want to make sure that the prices that we're going to get are as well defined as possible in an attempt to minimize the problem that you just brought up. Yeah. We are very acutely aware of that issue and are doing what we can to minimize that.
In the discussions of the cost overruns, did they identify a certain process or something that they could say, you know, we didn't do enough work on?
I think one thing that was kind of discussed was the lack of understanding in the beginning. Like, there was no dedicated IT staff that understood the administrative process, you know, from both sides. So that kind of you know, gave some misinformation over how to handle the upgrade.
That's one big thing. And the other big thing is that there always seems to be some misunderstanding on what the system functionality that the system wants versus the functionality that the vendor thinks that the system wants.
Right.
And that causes a lot of the cost overruns as well.
Yeah, so it's a huge undertaking. No
it
question.
Is.
Mike?
So one last thing. Let's just go ahead and get this out here. Would you like me to bring back an item next month regarding the formation of a committee to go through this process? And we can get that out
there.
Talk
about an investment committee?
Yep.
Yeah. I think it's worthwhile.
Good idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. If it's going to make our monthly meetings more like this month than last month, then I'm in favor of it.
Should I be worried?
No, you already volunteered to be chair. So that's not a problem.
Will we have to make that part of our bylaws and all that other business?
Yes. I would think we would have to call it out in the bylaws, I would imagine. Well, this is probably going to go on for a while, right?
The question I've seen with the investment committees is whether the authority is actually delegated to the committee to take action. If it's not, then the same, then it becomes a duplication of effort, rather than a streamline.
Yeah. Sure.
And the chair can authorize
the board. It's within the chair's discretion.
Yep.
There are some systems, I believe, that have standing investment committees, and I think part of the discussion should be whether or not we want this to be an ad hoc for a period of time, relegated to just this item, or whether we want this to actually be an ongoing committee. I think that's worth discussion as part of the overall. Okay, if there are no other comments or questions, then we are adjourned.